It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Where does the governor's race stand now that two Democratic contenders, State Assemblyman Dana Walks and businessman Andy Gronick, have dropped out of the race? Who's next as the Democratic Party winnows its candidate roster down to one who will face Governor Scott Walker? We're assessing the state of the governor's race and other political trends in Wisconsin with Mordecai Lee. He's a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, I have also heard you on as a regular guest on this show. It is good to finally meet you.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Carrie.
So let's get into this. Democratic gubernatorial candidates Dana Walks and Andy Gronick both dropped out last week within about a day of each other. What does this news tell us about where we're at this point in the governor's race, which is, the primary is a couple of months away and the general election is about 5 months away?
Carrie, I think this is something of a good news, bad news joke in the sense of, the good news is now there are only eight candidates running for governor.
Only eight.
And the bad news is there are eight running for governor.
Right.
And, you know, by that I mean that choice is good. There was nothing inherently wrong with having 10 candidates. It is true that it would be hard for voters to really scrutinize in detail the views and issues of 10 different candidates. So theoretically, it's slightly easier with eight candidates, but you know, on the other hand, I was glad you mentioned the backgrounds of the two people who dropped out, that one of them is a business person from the Milwaukee area, evidently successful. Another one is a sitting state representative who's from outside the Madison-Milwaukee axis of sort of urban Milwaukee or Wisconsin. So I think to a certain extent that's a loss, too, because presumably what the voters are doing is, you know, it's sort of like going into 31 flavors. You know, they look around, they say, who do I like, what do I like, and now they've got fewer choices. So this is not necessarily sort of great news. I realize it's easier for the voters, but I don't think there had been anything wrong with having 10.
You know, the 31 flavors thing, it takes a while to get to taste all of the flavors. Is it possible that they should have stayed in longer so people could have, like, you know, gotten a taste of who they are?
Boy, Carrie, now you've really gotten to the heart of the political dynamic that's going on behind the curtain. You know, so Marquette University Law School poll issues the results of the most recent poll. Only one person is in double digits, the state superintendent. Everybody else is in single digits. And then you've got two candidates within a day or two say, I can't break into this. I'd be knocking my head against the wall for the next 2 months. I'm going to drop out. I have to say, I sort of think that's unfortunate because the voters benefit from, you know, competition, from contrast, from choices. But the big thing that's hanging over, you know, breaking into double digits is probably something like $1 million. In other words, if right now the name recognition is based in part on the fact that somebody has name recognition, that they're sort of well-known, as this, you would expect a superintendent who's been elected to three terms would be,
mm-hmm.
How do you buy that kind of name recognition? After all, it's probably unlikely that the Democrats who responded to that Marquette poll said, I've looked at all 10 candidates, I've examined all 10 candidates, and after going through a sifting and winnowing process, I've picked the superintendent. Now, that would be great in a kind of ideal form of democracy, but what's probably going on is the pollster who called them said, you know, what name are you familiar with, and read the names, and they said, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with Evers. And so he's got a leg up, and then the question becomes, in a democracy, what does it take to get another leg up? And I suspect it's $1 million.
Right.
In other words, if any candidate had $1 million and they could do a saturation TV buy for, let's say, 10 days, statewide, they could introduce themselves to the voters. And presumably, if it was a bit sort of funny or unusual, people would then remember. And then all of a sudden, you'd have a candidate after $1 million who'd also be in the 20s or 30s, maybe even in the 40s. And that really gets indirectly back to the issue of what does it take to win elections? And unfortunately, what it takes is not just name recognition, but a ton of money.
And that's essentially what's happening in Illinois, where you have two billionaires running against each other.
Right. And it's sort of odd that we've gotten to this place in American politics where to get into the poker game, to be able to ante up, you need to be able to throw around a couple of $1 million. And I don't have anything against billionaires. Some of my best friends are billionaires. I wish.
Me too.
And Herb Kohl was a fabulous example of a publicly spirited citizen who had money, didn't need to raise funds. Everybody recognized that he was an independent and that he was a fair-minded, reliable person. And so we really didn't hold it against him that he could finance his own campaigns. But what about if you're not Tony Evers, you're one of the other seven candidates, you're probably cold calling 6 hours a day, begging people for money because you know what it takes to break out. And I can tell you from the brief time that I was in politics, there's nothing worse than cold calling rich people and asking for money. It's just the most degrading, humiliating thing in the world. And the people who get called are on a kind of a list that everybody calls them because their names appear as previous contributors. And gosh, it's just a bad transaction from both ends of the phone call.
We are talking about the governor's race today with Mordechai Lee, who is a professor, but also a former state senator and state assemblyman. I should note that you mentioned Herb Kohl. He started the Kohl's chain. His family started the Kohl's chain. He was also a United States senator from Wisconsin back in, I want to say, the 90s. Am I right there?
I think you're right. I probably stepped down. I'm trying to remember what the sequence was. He served, I believe it was three terms.
So let's get back to this governor's race here. They do have to raise money. Dana Walks and Andy Gronick did actually put their own money in. One would suspect they had $1 million, but maybe decided that that was a sinkhole and they didn't particularly want to lose another 800 grand trying to run. What do you say to that?
Oh, that's a great point. In other words, these weren't people who sort of did nothing. They were able to put money in their campaigns. And now we're getting to a sort of a second element of successful political campaigns, and that it's easy to spend money. The money goes out the front door like water. Mm-hmm. But then the question is, does it have an impact? And it's very easy, for example, to spend a lot of money on salaries. When Governor Walker was running for president and he had this huge infrastructure of a campaign committee, he was spending about $1 million a day. And a lot of it was on field organizers, for example, in Iowa, New Hampshire. And salaries and then, pollsters and advisors, that costs a ton of money. So presumably what happened with these two candidates is they said, well, maybe I could put more into it, but would it really pay off? Would it really catch on? And the problem with politics is that sometimes things catch on. Sometimes a candidate comes out of nowhere and suddenly becomes hot. But you sort of don't know if that's going to happen until the day of the election. And they had to think through, how much money could I raise? How much money of my own money could I put in for the next 2 months? What are the chances that I would catch on? And I suspect they just sort of were ultimately pragmatic. We sort of think of candidates who run for office as sort of self-starting, highly motivated people who almost irrationally think they'll succeed. And and sometimes there are fairy tales like that. But more often than not, politicians are really cold, calculating thinking machines. And I suspect the two of them said, I just don't think I'm going to be able to break out, and sort of, what's the point? Now, I sort of feel bad for Dana Walks, in the sense of he's an incumbent member of the state assembly. And the filing deadline for running for re-election to the state assembly was the same day as filing papers to run for governor. And so he effectively is now out of politics. He can't run for re-election to the state assembly. So he paid a price. And the price was, when does the Marquette poll come out?
The Marquette poll pretty much drove this decision, didn't it?
It really did, and that's sort of the unfortunate side of the affair. And I'm not in any way criticizing Charles Franklin, who's the professor who runs it. I think Charles is the best pollster in Wisconsin, and I think his poll is the gold standard for Wisconsin politics. So we should assume with credibility that the results were fair and reasonable and accurate. And
But maybe
but
too
really,
soon?
Do we really want elections to be driven by polls?
Right. Well, it may be too soon. Maybe wait a little while to see how things shake out before running a poll?
Exactly. And so for the two of these candidates to drop out, it must have been a real blow to them in the sense of, let's say for the last two, three, four, five, 6 months. They've been running hard. They've been running, you know, 18 hours a day. They've been sleeping in their cars. They've been eating fast food. They've been knocking their heads against the wall. And then they wake up and they see this poll, and somehow all of their efforts didn't feel like it made a difference. And that must have been just greatly crushing. And perhaps the same cycle will happen. I suspect that Professor Franklin is going to be issuing polls on a closer basis, maybe once a month, perhaps.
We'll look at that and maybe have you back on once a month to talk about this stuff. Mordecai Lee is a professor and former state lawmaker. He's weighing in on Wisconsin's gubernatorial race. We are taking your calls this morning, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're spending our first hour this morning assessing the state of the governor's race that two Democrats, Dana Walks and Andy Gronick, have dropped out of. Mordecai Lee spent a decade and a half in the legislature and is sharing his wisdom with us today. Do you think any of the current Democratic candidates have a chance of beating Walker? Who are you voting for? Who did you vote for last time? 1-800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Mordecai, did you think that the Democratic field would start winnowing so soon? Or did you think that more people would hold out till the primary? And now that it has started winnowing, do you feel like more people are going to drop out sooner than later?
Carrie, I really was surprised. I'd never seen a situation where a poll came out and promptly two people dropped out of the race. But, you know, presumably when they filed their nomination papers just a couple weeks ago, they were sort of in. They were going to stay in the game. Now dropping out has to be a disappointment for them and sort of is an indication that maybe they just felt they weren't going to be able to do it. And, you know, we're a long way from the primary. The primary is about 2 months away. Just in political time, that's an eternity. Anything can happen. But it must have been hard for them. I think what's going to happen now is we're going to see an informal shaking out. You might call this a kind of an invisible sub-primary. Because just like the Republican Party has its different silos, like the values voters or the Tea Party or the Trump people, the Democratic Party has its silos, although they're not quite as visible to us on the outside. You could say there's a Bernie Sanders wing of the party, for example, and you could say there's sort of a Clinton wing of the party. They're more moderate. The Bernie Sanders people are more ideological, more leftish. I think we might be seeing some sub-primaries going on between the remaining eight candidates, with some of them bumping each other to say, I'm the Bernie Sanders candidate, and another one saying, no, I'm the Bernie Sanders candidate. And so they won't necessarily be running against seven other people. They might consider themselves running against, let's say, two or three who are...
Okay, let's talk about the subgroups within the remaining eight people. Who are the people who are the more ideological leftist candidates? Who are the people who are more middle-of-the-road candidates?
I think I'll let them identify themselves. And if I had to go through all seven, you know, the show would practically be over.
True.
But they'll manifest themselves. There's no way that you'll have one of the eight candidates running a TV ad criticizing seven other candidates, you know, an attack ad.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even say all seven names in a 30-second commercial. But if we start seeing the sort of compare and contrast that'll happen in some of the debates or some of the press releases, we'll get a sense of who they think they're competing with. And then it could well be that by the time we get down to the primary, these sub-primaries will have sort of shaken out, and there might be, let's say, three or four or five, I don't know what to call them, senior candidates or well-funded candidates that have minimal name recognition or that seem to be getting hot. So I think there will be some movement. Ultimately, what it comes down to is what is the orientation of the primary voters? For those who vote in August, they've sort of got a choice. You know, we started talking about 31 flavors. It could be they go in the polling booth in the middle of August and they say, what's my favorite flavor? Who's my favorite candidate? Who do I like the most? And vote for that candidate. On the other hand, there'll probably be some pragmatic primary voters who say, I don't care if I like this person or not. I don't care their gender. I don't care their profession. I don't care what part of the state they come from. But I think this person is the person who has the best chance of beating Governor Walker. Mm. That's a totally sort of different kind of consideration, a pragmatic one as opposed to a falling in love one. And I think some of those candidates might appeal more to the latter category. In other words, they've shown themselves that they can take the heat, they can respond on their feet, they're very verbal, they don't freeze like a deer in the headlights. So that might ultimately become part of the public debate over who are we being Democratic voters, going to vote for.
You just talked about people sort of dropping out and maybe throwing their... I know that Dana Walks actually threw his support towards Tony Evers. Does that kind of... If somebody drops out and says, "Yeah, I'm leaving the race, but vote for this guy," does that give the other guy much more credibility? And can there be deals that are being made behind the scenes here?
It's possible. That's pretty normal in politics. I think you're right about Dana Walks endorsing a candidate, but I think that Gronick also endorsed a different candidate. So this in and of itself is sort of giving us a sense of these clusters of voters. You can go back to, what was it, the race of Andrew Jackson against John Quincy Adams, where Andrew Jackson said there had been some kind of a foul agreement that led to Adams winning the election. There's a phrase that's not coming to mind right now, but do sometimes candidates say, "Hey, if you drop out, I'll make you the Secretary of DNR," or something like that, or not quite saying it because that would violate the law.
Right.
Yeah, there probably are. Sort of join my team, give me your call list, give me your contributors, be my partner, and
we'll see what happens.
Be part of my team if I win.
We are taking your calls, talking about the governor's race today, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. David from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a great topic. I've really got a boner to pick with these pollsters. You know, last presidential election, I stayed home because I heard Hillary had it in the bag.
Mm.
And I personally, I suffered tremendously. I am undocumented and I'm a gender fluid. And I can't believe what I'm suffering now because these pollsters convinced me we didn't have to worry. You know, they told us everyone knew who to vote for. And on all the major stations, they were just they said it's okay. We're good people are going to win, not the evil country people. And I'm just really sick of these pollsters because then the evil country people might win. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, David. So, Mordecai, David says that they stayed home because the pollster said there was nothing wrong. There's nothing. Hillary is going to win. And that was his candidate. And they didn't go need to vote. What do you say to that?
That's a fabulous call and a very important one. In other words, that we should read polls with a certain circumspection. And I think the first thing that Professor Franklin would say is that we need to treat polls, first of all, as sort of fuzzy results. In other words, when he has a margin of error of, let's say, 4%, 5%, or 6%, think of how those numbers could change within the margin of error. So we have to read the numbers not as accurate ones, at precise ones, but rather as range ones. And I'm sure that Professor Franklin would also say that we have to remember that no matter how good his methodology, that this is a snapshot of that day. It's not a prediction of what will happen 60 days from now mm-hmm. or 90 days from now. It's just this is how people are feeling today. And Wisconsinites are notorious at evolving their feelings and changing their feelings. And they get up one morning and they've changed their mind about something. So I'm glad David called because it's a good reminder to us to put the poll results from last week in perspective and not view it as this is it, it's all over.
So what's the solution to this? There are some countries that say there is limited polling. You can't poll too early. You can't poll too close to the election. Do news media need to cover polls in a different way? There's not a whole lot that we look at and treat it as fuzzy. If it's important enough to be on the news, then we're going to treat it as a cut in stone thing.
And the attention that we're giving the Marquette poll is deserved because Charles Franklin is such an outstanding pollster. His methodology is solid. He He's definitely nonpartisan, middle of the road. He's not slanting anything. I think we just have to view a poll within the larger context, which is each one of us is a citizen, and we're not bound by those results and by our very democratic involvement. Democratic involvement, I mean, with a small d, we can change those results. And I'm pretty sure that things will change by the next poll. I'm pretty sure some people will move into a higher tier, perhaps be in double-digit recognition. There are fairy tales in politics where nobody does suddenly get elected, gets hot. So we really do have to put it in that kind of limited perspective.
We are talking about the governor's race with Mordecai Lee. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. George from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
I'm a Mike McCabe supporter. I think that McCabe can beat Walker. I think that's what Democrats are looking for the most. I think he's much more energetic and exciting than Tony Evers. I think he also has the ability to peel off a few percentage points from Walker's huge lead in rural Wisconsin. And I guess that's the major reason why I'm supporting him. Plus, I think he's the most decent and perhaps an independent guy out there.
Thank you, George. I appreciate that. Mordecai, Mike McCabe, and rural Wisconsin. That's kind of an odd thing that's happening right now. There are all these special elections in some rural areas, some of which have gone blue. Are rural people looking for something to send a message to Scott Walker, to send a message perhaps to Donald Trump?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there's a blue wave going on. The results of the last two special elections, where the Dems won the state Senate and the Republicans retained the state assembly, sort of is an indication that it is a blue wave, but it's not a blue tsunami. In other words, there are high watermarks where Republicans can hold on to an office. But there being a blue wave is different from the choices that a primary voter has to make. After all, these are Democratic voters. Mm. I'm glad that George called. He's identified a candidate he likes. He explained why he likes that person. Presumably, there's a lot going on behind the curtain that we can't see of some candidates successfully building a grassroots organization or successfully building donors, small donors, being on, let's say, rural radio stations or town hall meetings, where some of this stuff won't start becoming apparent in the polls for a while. The takeoff takes a really long time. You need a long runway to get into double digits.
Mm-hmm.
But people like George who are out there are the ones who are going to make a difference, because if you have, let's say, eight candidates still in the race in August, and in Wisconsin to win a partisan primary, you simply need a plurality. You don't need a majority. You need a plurality. So all of a sudden, a Mike McCabe or any of the other candidates could perhaps win the primary with, 20% of the vote. It's far from a majority, but it might be more than everybody else. And so there are sort of really theoretical problems, I think, with the lack of runoff primaries. But a person like McCabe, for them to think, hey, can I get 15, 20, 25% of the vote, that becomes more realistic than saying, can I raise $5 million and can I win 51% of the vote?
We are talking about the governor's race and taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You just mentioned, Mordecai, a runoff primary, and John from Glendale has a question that is along those lines. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, I wanted to ask Professor Lee if he thought ranked choice voting might have allowed them to stay in the race a little longer.
Ranked choice voting. This is something that happened in Maine recently. We're actually going to do a show on it in the future, where you pick your first two or three choices, and if the first choice doesn't get some sort of plurality, then it goes to the next two. Mordecai, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, John has really nailed it. The argument against having runoff primaries in Wisconsin would be that it's the cost of having another election. This is common down in the South and a couple other states, but it's not common for Wisconsin. Now, believe it or not, Wisconsin did have what's called second-choice voting, the way you described it, Kerry, back in 1911 to 1913 or so. It was part of the progressives' effort, the La Follette effort, to create a more democratic with a small d, system. And because they felt that in Republican primaries, they wanted to have a kind of a one-on-one showdown between the progressive Republican and the what we call the stalwart Republicans. It didn't work very successfully. It was very complicated. I don't think it's that complicated. I think we should do it. If Maine can do it, we can do it. It's simply saying to the voter, look, if your preferred candidate doesn't win, and if you knew that when you walked into the booth today, who would you have voted for? And then you mark a number two next to that other name.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of relatively easy to do, especially now that we have computers. I really wish we'd have it. I think both parties would benefit by having the winner of of their partisan primary to be the choice of really the majority as opposed to the plurality.
Right. So the ranked choice voting, like you could get the winner could get 33%, but the number two person could have 40%. 40% of the people thought, yeah, this person is my second choice. And
Right. You might call it an instant runoff.
Right.
Believe it or not, I did introduce a bill to do that when I was in the state legislature, and it didn't even get a hearing. I mean, it went nowhere. But it's still a good idea. I'm glad John called.
We are talking about the governor's race, and we are talking to you, taking your phone calls, 800-642-1234. I want to go back to this Marquette poll, Mordecai. It says that Walker's job approval rating is 47%. His disapproval is 49%. His disapproval is 47%. This is the first time his approval has been ahead of his disapproval for a very long time. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, when he ran for president, he really cratered in Wisconsin. I mean, he came back to Wisconsin, and he was in the 30s. And you have to give him credit for what a fabulous politician he is, that he's really clawed his way back from near political death, and now he's slightly in positive territory for the first time since then. But the results, again, it's a good news, bad news joke. He's 49-47, but he's 49-47. You know, when you're an incumbent governor, to have 47% of the people against you is a substantial hurdle. I think we should look at the 49-47 with the same sort of fuzzy way to look at precise numbers. In other words, he's 49%, give or take about 5%, and his opposition is 47%, give or take 4 or 5%.
We are exploring the gubernatorial campaign in Wisconsin in the wake of a new poll by Marquette University Law School that winnowed the Democratic field a bit. We'll talk about the rest of the field, and we're going to take your calls in a moment. It's The Morning Show. Listening to the Ideas Network, I'm Carrie Kaufman. The governor's race is starting to take shape as two Democrats left the field last week after a Marquette University Law School poll showed them with very low voter support. With us this morning to assess the state of the remaining candidates is UW-Milwaukee professor and former state representative and senator Mordecai Lee. What do you think of the narrowing Democratic field? Do any of the remaining eight candidates have a shot at beating Scott Walker, who is running for a third term? Does President Trump hurt or help Walker in your estimation? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Mordecai, let's take a look at the Democrats who are still in the race. I know that I asked you this before, but I'm going to try this again. Who do you think has the advantage? Is Evers the guy, or can he be beat?
I think it's a relatively open race, notwithstanding the results of the poll, particularly if the Evers number is more of name recognition than anything else. And I'm not begrudging that or belittling it. Toronto's successful campaign is sort of, there's a secret sauce. There's a magic sauce. You need name recognition, which he has. Any candidate would need an adequate amount of money, would need to have an adequate amount of campaign volunteers and organizers, would have to be sort of good with the media, would have to have issues that catch fire. It's sort of a constantly changing balance. So he has probably the best chance of winning, assuming nothing changes. But I think things will change. I think it'll narrow down into a competitive race, and that's in the best interest of Wisconsinites.
So at the Democratic convention, Kelda Royce won the straw poll. She did not poll that well in the Marquette University poll. Where do you think she stands?
Well, you've really nailed it, Carrie, in the sense of that in the straw poll, there were, I think it was maybe a couple thousand, maybe less than a couple thousand delegates to the Democratic convention who cast votes. She won by a plurality. It was viewed as significant political news. In fact, I heard somebody refer to her as the front runner.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, then the poll comes out and she's in single digits. So this is sort of the perfect example of the problem of breaking out in a field of so many candidates. But I think it is going to happen. I think there is going to be a coalescing around a couple of them.
So let's talk about money in this race for a moment. There are a lot of people that are sitting on their hands and kind of waiting to see who shakes out. There's a lot of outside money coming into this race. Is Paul Walker already getting that money, and are Democrats missing out on that outside money because they can't figure out who's going to run yet?
Well, there's no doubt that for somebody who's a Democratic contributor and who wants to see the Democratic Party beat Walker in the fall, that they have an incentive to give money after the primary. Presumably, if the person who wins the primary is considered sort of viable, acceptable, has a good chance of winning. Putting money into a campaign now before the primary is sort of like venture capital. In the sense of you're taking a long shot, oh, I really like this person, I'll give him $1,000. But generally speaking, the big money and the large outside groups that are part of the blue wave will come in afterwards. Scott Walker has, in a sense, the advantage and disadvantage that he's unopposed and he can bring in outside money, and he's a fabulous fundraiser from national sources. And he's on the air. For example, in the last week, he said he should be treated as the education governor. In other words, he's trying to define himself ahead of perhaps Mr. Evers being the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the disadvantage to Walker is he doesn't know who his opponent is. So he can't start softening up his opponent until after the primary. So it's a kind of a good news, bad news situation. I think I heard that the Democratic Party is trying to raise money to give to the primary winner sort of like the next day. In other words, so they won't be in the situation of Tommy Thompson when he won a primary for U.S. Senate, and his Democratic opponent was Congresswoman Baldwin, but that Tommy was sort of broke after winning the primary, and he had to spend a couple of weeks raising money. The Democrats want to avoid that syndrome happening here.
We are talking about the governor's race for the next about 9 minutes of the show. 800-642-1234. Chris from Marshfield, welcome to the program.
Yeah, great show. And I just got to say, you know, I really don't like Scott Walker, but the Democratic Party keeps putting up candidates that just don't win my vote. They're really not getting it that people in Wisconsin don't want to be told how to think. And that's exactly what Soglin and Evers do. And I'm not happy with the education system. My kids go to Catholic school to eighth grade, and they do great. But then they get to high school, They're already doing sophomore-level classes as freshmen, but you still wonder, where's the education? Because they're not really getting educated. And so the Democrats, I don't think they even have a winner on the slate.
So what is it that you want to hear from a Democrat?
I would love to see a Democrat who is at least either pro-business or pro-gun or pro-small government. One of the three. Just one of the three.
Okay, so hang on a second, though. Andrew Gronick was a businessman, pro-business. Kathleen Veinhout is definitely pro-gun. I don't know of any of them that are small government. Mordecai, do you?
Well, I'm really glad Chris called, because to a certain extent, the question is, what can parties do about what he just described?
Hmm.
And, you know, 4 years ago, the party coalesced very early around Mary Burke and felt that she had a good chance of beating Scott Walker.
And she was pro-business.
She was pro-business. She was a businesswoman. She was a successful businesswoman. And yet Scott Walker made mincemeat of her. And so when I think about Chris's comment, the perception that parties select their nominee is not accurate for Wisconsin. We have a truly open, democratic with a small d, political system. And so the party is not deciding who its nominee will be in the sense of some smoke-filled room. It's people like Chris. And so, of course, you'd expect me as a professor of government to say to the people like Chris out there, well, if there is of the eight a candidate you like and who you would love to see being the nominee to run against Scott Walker, then I have to tell you, you've got an open political system. You can get involved. You can work for them. You can donate to them. You can go door-to-door for them. And then maybe you can affect the results. But it doesn't occur in a smoke-filled room. It really is the choice of the voters.
So, Chris, I got to ask you, are you willing to go out and figure out who's your person and go out and work for them? Or do you want them to come to you? Oh, Chris is gone. Sorry. So we are taking your calls, and we're talking to Stan in Nashota. Stan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello.
Hello. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yeah, well, actually, I have a comment about a caller from a little while ago. Someone called and said they didn't vote because of the Marquette poll showing Hillary was certain to win. And, of course, she lost. And my point is that no matter what the poll says, people should get out and vote. If I recall correctly, Trump won Wisconsin by 20,000 votes.
Right.
And after the election, the publicity was that Wisconsin, or that Milwaukee alone could have swung the election if people had gotten out to vote. So Professor Lee, I think, would agree with me that no matter what the polls show, people should ignore the polls and get out and vote for their candidate. If people had voted in the last election in Wisconsin, I think that the pundits would have said that Hillary would have won. And I think that may have also been the case in Michigan and Pennsylvania. So,
excellent point, Stan. Excellent point. I should note that it wasn't just the Marquette poll that had Hillary winning. It was every poll in the country that had Hillary winning. And Mordecai, I got to tell you, the question that I would most like to ask voters in Wisconsin isn't did you vote, but do you regret your actions in 2016? I would like to know how many people will say, no, I absolutely don't regret my actions. Yay, Trump, or we have to have the purity of the left. And how many people, like David, say, oh, my God, I wish I had voted, or I wish that I hadn't thrown away my vote?
Well, there's no doubt that, Stan is right. I think the handicaps that we have to keep in mind is that Wisconsin used to have its partisan primary the week after Labor Day. In other words, kids are back in school, people are back at work, nobody's on summer vacation anymore, they're tilting to the fall, so they're ready to think about elections. We had to move our primary up by a month to the middle of August because of some federal requirements that had to do with military ballots abroad. And I think that's a problem because in the middle of August, college students aren't at school, so they're not voting. People are on summer vacation. People aren't thinking about politics. So I don't think that the August primary is particularly sort of prime territory for a high turnout. And so the chances of a fluke of a result are very strong, because the number of people turning out to vote is going to be relatively limited. I guess it's going to be only about 25% of the voters. Mm-hmm. And remember, there can't be a crossover vote in August, because Republicans will be on the Republican side of the ballot because they want to vote in the U.S. Senate primary. So there's no crossover vote. It's just Dems voting for governor.
You know, when I first came here, I talked to people who said the issue isn't that Wisconsin has great Republican candidates. It's that they have not that great Democratic candidates. Do you agree with that?
Well, I sort of, in the sense that the Republican Party is a very well-organized, cohesive organization. I think you'd call it the Republican machine, because there are a group of activists and supporters who really act together. They acted that way just a couple of weeks ago in the upcoming primary for the first congressional district. They informally decided who they liked to be Paul Ryan's successor. It's the old Will Rogers quip. I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And that's very true about Democrats in Wisconsin.
We have been talking about the governor's race. Who are you going to vote for? Engage with us online on Twitter at WPR.org, WPR Mornings. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. We appreciate Mordecai Lee, who has spent the hour talking with us today about the governor's race. The field is winnowed to 8 people. Mordecai Lee says it probably needs to be winnowed a little more. Mordecai, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Carrie.
I'm Carrie Kaufman, and I'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network.